Hello, I'm Becky Sweet, and I am very pleased to be with David Newham today to talk about his career in the newspaper industry. David, you found some interesting paperwork yesterday.
I did, purely by accident, really. I know you had invited me to have this chat with you, but by coincidence, I had to file away some papers, and while doing so, I found this letter, which is addressed to me in June of 1960 and relates to my first job in the newspaper business. I'd written a letter, a very cheeky letter, I'm sure, as a 16-year-old, to the editor of the local weekly paper in Derbyshire, where I lived. And very much to my surprise, I got invited to an interview. And after the interview, I was offered a job. And this letter confirms that offer, a starting salary of £3.19.6 per week, plus out-of-pocket expenses. I was absolutely thrilled and delighted because I really had not expected to get such a positive reply. And so I did start work. Certainly by today's standards, I was very young to start work in newspapers. I don't think any newspaper today would take on a 17-year-old as a junior reporter. Most people going into the newspaper business or into the media generally are people who've had further education, probably got a degree, and are at least 5 years older than that. At the time, it was very exciting for me, obviously, and I went into a reporter's room that was full of much older people. And of course, to begin with, I did have some fairly menial jobs, but I very soon learned the basics and started writing things which appeared in print, which was pretty exciting at the time.
And newspapers at that time will have been produced very differently.
Yes, they were. That has been the major change, and it's quite astonishing, really, how the industry has changed in terms of its production. When I went in, newspapers were still being produced in a way that people would have recognised from, well, certainly 80 or 90 years before. There was still a whole printing department involved in the creation of the pages of the newspaper. In the reporter's room, we had typewriters and pieces of paper, and you wrote in double spacing on using a typewriter, or in fact you could even write by hand and leave plenty of space in it. And in fact, quite a bit of our copy, as it was called, the reports that came into us, were handwritten. And then once they'd been edited by a sub-editor and had instructions put on them for the kind of typeface that they should be set in and the headlines to go on them, they went into what we generally called the works, which was where all the print craftspeople were, and usually they would go first of all to a linotype operator, and a linotype was a huge clanking machine with a keyboard of sorts, nothing like a typewriter keyboard, but much bigger than that, and various other controls on it. And it also had a huge pot of molten metal attached to the back of it, and basically it produced lines of metal type. The operator would sit there and type on a keyboard until he'd produced a line of type, and then he would use other controls to produce this line of metal type, which would eventually form the whole story that would go into the newspaper page. There would be various procedures to go through before it actually got onto the page. First of all, there was a process called reading. There was an official department called the reader's room or the reader's department in all newspapers. And after the linotype operator had set the whole story, what he had done, his work was then proofed. An ink proof would be taken of the type, and that proof with the original copy, as provided by the journalists, would be scrutinised by the readers. And one person would have the original copy in their hands, and the other person would have the proof of the type that had been provided by the linotype operator, and they would go through it. One would read it, and one would mark off any corrections that needed to be made. And then after any corrections had been made and everyone was happy, then this would go to another area where the whole page would be made up. It was always called the stone for very strange and archaic reasons, because it wasn't made of stone at all. It was a very large, heavy, strong metal table. And the type would be assembled inside what was really a kind of adjustable metal frame into columns, and also pictures were added. That was the other thing that's changed a lot over the years. When I first went into the newspaper business, photographers used quite old-fashioned cameras, black and white, of course. Some of them had plate cameras, even. Some of them had 2¼ square cameras. They printed their black and white photographs, and those photographs were taken to a reprographic department, and they produced metal plates, which were incorporated into the page, so that eventually you had a page made up of metal type and reprographic plates, etched plates for the photographs, and then the whole thing would be taken to yet another mechanical department, where this was turned into a semicircular shaped metal block that was put onto the printing presses. It was very heavily dependent on very old-fashioned printing skills. And over the course of years, towards the end of my career, all of those skills were slowly removed from the process by various stages of computerisation.
It certainly has changed a lot since then. You've been in Norwich since 1973, and Norwich has a particularly interesting history in regard to provincial newspapers.
It does, yes. I'm no expert on it, but I do know that the people who founded the paper, which became what is today's Eastern Daily Press, and the company that became the publisher of the Eastern Daily Press, they were all rather, if you like, free-thinking, liberal-minded people. Some of them very much political, in the sense that they were affiliated to the Liberal Party. All of them were non-conformist on a religious footing. Either they were Methodist, or they were Quakers, or whatever. They weren't part of the established church, and they were very keen to have some input into the opinions that were doing the rounds in Norwich towards the second half of the 19th century. And what is today the Eastern Daily Press and the Evening News came from those founding fathers. In fact, the company, although it's changed its name from what, when I first joined, it was called Eastern Counties Newspapers, it's now called Archant, that company still has, it's still a privately owned company. It's not a, it doesn't have shares on the open market. And a lot of the original families are still involved in the business.
And they're famous Norfolk family names.
Yes, they are. Certainly the Colmans were very involved in it, and the Tillotts. The Gerrolds were involved at different times. They didn't. I mean, certainly when I joined the company, the chairman was still a member of the Coleman family, and a member of the Copeman family was on the board. And in fact, eventually he became the chairman of the company. So those two families in particular had been with the company right from the start.
There's an interesting plaque on Redwell Street about the Norwich Gazette.
Yes. There is, and I'm a little bit ignorant about that, but I know that Norwich was one of the first cities in the country to have its own independent newspaper. I suppose that's not so surprising, really, in that Norwich, well, right from the sort of Elizabethan times, was a very important city up until the Industrial Revolution, when the power, as it were, moved away from cities like Norwich to the new industrial centres, either in the Midlands or the North. Norwich was a very, very important centre, and so maybe it's not surprising that Norwich was leading the way in the you know, in the 1700s as far as newspapers were concerned.
Samuel Johnson coined the phrase "the commerce of information," which is very forward-looking given the current state of play for newspapers and digitization and where and how we find our information today. I think your final project before you retired was to do digitization.
Yes, it was. And I'm not quite sure how it came about, but for various reasons, I had got quite familiar with a lot of the new technology that was coming in the late 1980s, you know, making up pages on a computer screen and that kind of thing. It hadn't stretched into many newspapers at that time, but it was obviously the way that newspapers were moving. It became important that the newspapers here in Norwich needed to take account of that, and they began researching it, and I was given responsibility on the editorial side for looking into that. We looked around to see if there was a kind of off-the-shelf solution that was available to newspapers. And we quickly found that at that time there wasn't anything off-the-shelf that we could buy in. And so we decided to build our own, basically, using you know, well-known software packages to do some of the work, things like Microsoft Word, which was used for the editing and word-pressing side of it, and then Quark Express, which was establishing itself as the best kind of page makeup software. But what we had to try and do locally was to use those in a way in which we could integrate them into a controlling and a management system using databases. And both software packages could be tailored and could be integrated into database systems so that the reporter could write a report on his computer, and it wouldn't just disappear into a black hole. It would be filed to a publication and to a date and to perhaps a classification like news or sport or features or whatever, and so that it would then be possible for other people in the editorial department to find that and say, okay, we're going to use this in today's edition of the EDP, and we are going to put it on page 9. And then they could farm it out to sub-editors who would again be sitting at a computer with Quark Express, and all of the stories that had been allocated to that page could then be accessed by that sub-editor and could be edited, and the page could be made, the sub-editor could decide how the page would finally look. And of course that misses out entirely a whole layer of what used to be the traditional method of producing newspapers, that, you know, the print departments and so on. And sadly, all of those departments disappeared in that revolution. I was involved in helping to develop that system locally with various very talented computer programmers and analysts who enabled us to create the software, but then we had actually to make it work and to retrain our staffs to use it, and that was really my responsibility towards the end. We had lots of branch offices, we had lots of weekly newspapers as well as the daily papers, and we sort of brought it in over a period of about, I think it must have been the best part of a year altogether, into the weekly papers and then into the feature departments of the daily papers, and then finally into the more sort of hurly-burly news pages of the daily papers. And that was an exciting time, a very exciting time. It didn't always work as well as we hoped it might, and there were some pretty scary, hairy moments, but we always managed to get the newspaper out. And eventually, I think in some ways we were trying to be ahead of our time in that the systems weren't as resilient as they are now. the kind of hiccups that we were having early on disappeared over a matter of some years, as both the software, the communications networks, and the hardware itself just became better at doing that kind of a job. I mean, we were trying things out right on the very sort of forefront of what was technically possible at the time. And we were doing it, really, because the company had made a decision to close down its old print centre in the centre of Norwich and move its print works out to Thorpe, where it is now. And we had to have a system available by the time that that press was available in Thorpe to simply have the whole thing digitised and send it by dedicated lines, as they were in those days, I don't know whether they still are, to the print centre in Thorpe. I mean, everything has changed so much in the last 20 years as far as computer technology and communications is concerned. And the internet came in just towards the end of our process of changing the local newspapers here into digital newspapers. And of course, the internet in itself has created a lot more challenges and changes in the way that newspapers operate.
And you digitised the library, which is a huge historical resource for the city.
Yes, it is. I mean, in the old days, what happened was that we had quite a substantial library staff, 3 or 4 people. And if we wanted to file a newspaper story, it was simply cut out of the newspaper and stuck on a bit of paper and put in an envelope and put in a filing cabinet. And that was down to the librarian as to choose how that was filed and what was important to be filed. And so if a newspaper reporter wanted to do a story maybe 12 months later about the same subject, he could go back and ask for the archive on that particular subject. And there were rows, walls of cabinets that were full of information about particular subjects, particular villages, particular places, particular companies, particular individuals. Lots of individuals had, you know, well-known individuals because they appeared in the news quite often. There were files with little yellowing bits of newspaper that probably sometimes went back decades about how they had been active in the city. And the same was true of photographs, because photographs had to be stored away. We stored away our negatives, but we also stored away our prints. And again, they were in filing cabinets, and they were filed alphabetically if there were people, or if it was a subject about the city, they would be filed. Each street almost had its own file, and all of the large businesses had files. So there were absolutely tons and tons and tons of black and white photographs in there, or eventually colour photographs as that came in. But once we had moved to a digital system, then we stopped needing to produce those prints. There was a kind of interregnum where we did still produce prints, and the prints were scanned and they went into the computer system. But eventually everyone got digital cameras, and so it was unnecessary anymore. And again, we had to find a system for managing this, because otherwise all the pictures would just go into a big, great jumble and you'd never be able to find them. So we had to find a management system for dealing with all of the photographs that were coming in from all of these digital cameras. And not only our own people, but of course from the national news agencies like the Press Association and the international agencies like Reuters and so forth.
And is the library open to the public?
It is, to the best of my knowledge. I think you would have to make an appointment to go and see it. But the bound volumes are still around. Some of them are getting a bit tatty now. But you may well be able to look up some of those on microfilm or on digitized versions now, because there's been a lot of work put in to digitize some of that old set of bound volumes, because they were getting very, very fragile, to say the very least. You know, newspapers from the second half of the 19th century aren't in terribly good condition today, and if they've been frequently opened and turned over. They're interesting to look at, but whether you'd actually see the real thing now or whether you'd see a digitised copy of them, I'm not sure.
Wonderful research resource, though.
Oh, they people. Are. They are. They're fascinating. There was a period whilst I was still working there where I used to visit Radio Norfolk about once every fortnight, and they would ask me to go back on what was in the news maybe 50 years before or 100 years before. And so I used to have one happy day about once a fortnight going into these rather dusty, crumbling archives and searching through them. And it was fascinating to see what is there and how it was reported.
Your career has spanned an incredible revolution in the industry. Thank you so much for telling us about it. I'm sure our listeners are going to be fascinated. So thank you very much, Mr. David Newham.
Thank you.